It is Monday, June the 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, Iraqis take Fallujah from Islamic State, but what happens now if IS loses Mosul?
They would be out of Iraq, they would be out of the city that al-Baghdadi used to declare his caliphate, and they would be squeezed ever more in Syria.
The British exit from the EU and the impact on U.S. politics, finding entrepreneurs, plus singer-actor Kris Kristofferson's memory loss. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iraqi forces have liberated the city of Fallujah from the Islamic State fighters following a month-long military offensive to seize control. James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, now a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. VOA's Victor Beatty asked him if he was surprised with the swiftness of the campaign.
I've argued for some time, Victor, that we can take down ISIS quickly if we combine elite ground forces, Iraqi, and I would prefer more U.S., with vigorous and aggressive use of American air power and other support. That's what we saw in this battle.
Apparently, airstrikes were key in clearing out areas before the Iraqi forces on the ground advanced.
Right, and ISIS has learned by now they're never going to win against American air power. So we need to roll these guys up. We need to do this faster and more aggressively. You saw what happened last week with the Russian and the U.S. fighters in southern Syria. We need to deal with the ISIS problem because it needs to be dealt with, Orlando, Paris, Brussels, but also because we've got even bigger problems in the Middle East that we have to focus on.
Well, what are the lessons now learned from your perspective on how Fallujah fell?
First of all, just go in there with rapid force, with good elite troops, either trained and with U.S. advisors or some U.S. troops spearheading it, and use of effective pinpoint airstrikes, and don't stop keeping the pressure on them. The other thing is they're being pressured in all fronts. They're being pressured around Mosul, they're being pressured around Raqqa, they're being pressured around Manbij to the northeast of Raqqa, their supply line from Turkey. So therefore, on every front, they're spread thin. And that's how you punch forward. This is basic military strategy.
Have you seen an evolution of the strategy in recent months?
Absolutely. You're seeing a lot more seriousness on the part of the U.S. military, and you're seeing a lot more liberal use of American power. This reflects decisions by President Obama and his advisors back in November. And it's finally bearing fruition. But it's still not fast enough. ISIS is still in charge of its key areas. That's Raqqa and that's Mosul. They're bigger cities. They'll fight harder. We need to start moving forward on them.
How quickly will that possibly take place, given the relative swift victory in Fallujah?
We should be tapping units, picking more aircraft, and figuring out, based on the requests of our commanders, how we can use our firepower more effectively and more kinds of firepower. We just started using Apache helicopters in the north, and we need to be working with local allies as well as with the Iraqi army. Of course, local allies are all we have in Syria.
Are you anticipating an offensive perhaps before the end of this year?
I think that you'll see certainly an offensive. We already have an offensive of sorts in Mosul. We have an offensive in the north of Raqqa. There was a push close to Raqqa last month, and then there was this push to Manbij back in, it has just fallen. So I think that you've got an offensive going on. Whether we'll actually enter Mosul before the end of the year, we'll have to see.
Would the fall of Mosul spell the end of Islamic State?
Yes. They would be out of Iraq. They would be out of the city that al-Baghdadi used to declare his caliphate. And they would be squeezed ever more in Syria.
What happens to Iraq and Syria once IS is defeated?
You know, that's a good question. There are people thinking about that. Iraq's easier because it does have a government. There are lots of problems between the Shia, the Kurds, and such. But, I mean, we worked these things out over the years. Now, Syria is a totally different thing. The biggest issue in Syria is not ISIS. It's this civil war.
James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, currently a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Still ahead on the program, the recent U.S. mass murder and any possible connection with the Islamic State. Among the other stories we're staying on top of here on The Voice of America, the Syrian opposition conveying concerns to Kabul over Afghan fighters in Syria, Ghana police vowing to remain neutral during the vote, plus the U.S. High Court set for a key abortion ruling. Expanded coverage on those stories, plus a lot more at voanews.com and always on our VOA mobile app. Britain's recent decision to leave the European Union and its impact on the U.S. presidential race. That's our next report. For some perspective, International Editions' Jim Stevenson speaks with our Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman.
Jim, there are undoubtedly echoes and shockwaves stemming from Britain's vote to leave the European Union. And there is some thought that those shockwaves could reach the U.S. presidential election. Interestingly, on the day when the world was absorbing this news, Republican presumptive nominee Donald Trump was in Scotland for the golf course that bears his name, this resort. And he had a lot to say about it. And his point was that the passions that led a majority of voters in Britain to opt to leave the European Union are very much like some of the currents that he believes propelled him to the nomination that he will be claiming just next month.
Scotland did not vote overwhelmingly, at least in that area, to leave, while folks to the south did want to leave. And here's Donald Trump in Scotland saying how great it is.
I don't know if he purposefully, you know, timed the trip to be there at that moment, but truly the timing couldn't have been any better or any worse, depending on your perspective. Here's the thing, though. There is this idea in the United States that has been shattered, in essence, or if not shattered, it has been called into question. And that is the assumption that polls can be believed, and that when you have a majority of people telling pollsters that they intend to vote one way and then they vote the other way, as appears to be the case in Britain, what does that mean for the United States? Are there a group of people who secretly like Donald Trump and believe his message, but who are telling pollsters that, no, they dislike him and they don't like his message? If, in fact, something similar to what occurred in Britain were to be manifesting itself in the United States, then maybe all the polls that we're seeing showing that Donald Trump has fallen far behind Hillary Clinton, maybe those polls aren't to be believed. And it adds a note of anxiety and a note of uncertainty to the U.S. presidential contest.
Brexit did create immediate financial shockwaves around the world. The U.S. markets were not immune. The Dow Jones Industrial dropping more than 600 points in one day. A couple trillion dollars around the world just evaporated after Brexit. And this is a concern, obviously, for voters here in the United States.
Here's another possible point of anxiety for Democrats as they look ahead. The United States economy has been in a sustained recovery almost since the beginning of Obama's term as president, going on 8 years now, but it's been a weak one. Typically, with an economy like the United States, it is so big that it can absorb any given shock. But there have been instances with oil shocks, the price of gasoline suddenly spiking in decades past, where it's really thrown the U.S. economy into a funk. And if this were to occur as Americans are preparing to go to the polls, if the economy slows down, if it in fact starts to shrink, or if a lot of people are suddenly thrown out of work, well, typically typically the party that's in power, the party occupying the White House, gets the blame. Now, if Donald Trump is tying himself to Brexit and Brexit is identified as the cause, will he be blamed? Will President Obama be blamed? And by extension, Hillary Clinton? Mm-hmm. We don't know. But it throws another big question mark into an election season that has been truly volatile to date and shows no sign of being less volatile as we go forward.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. Next, we turn our attention to what's happening on social media from the weekend about the British decision to leave the EU. My colleague G. Abby Lee is here with all the buzz. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Those in the UK are literally asking about the aftermath of the EU referendum. The number of people Googling "what happens if we leave the EU" skyrocketed 2 hours after the polls closed. And that's around Friday midnight in Britain. I learned about this through Twitter.
I see there, Gia. And from which account?
From Google Trends, at Google Trends. And it's an account run by Google's News Lab that specializes in data and visualization. It tweeted, "The number of people typing the question in Google search jumped 250% around midnight on Friday." One of the most popular replies to that tweet reads, "Surprised all these people didn't bother to research it before voting. Clearly, we have lots of blind #EUref voters."
I understand. Moving on to its political impact, did the outgoing British Prime Minister David Cameron tweet about his departure?
He didn't. But he did thank everyone who voted to stay in. He tweeted, "Thank you everyone who voted to keep Britain stronger, safer, and better off in Europe, and thousands of Add Stronger In campaigners around the UK." More than 14,000 people liked that tweet. But another politician did tweet about Cameron's departure, and that's none other than Nigel Farage, who is the leader of the UK Independence Party. He tweeted, "It's right that David Cameron has gone. Not a bad man, just on the wrong side of the argument." Back to you.
Many thanks, UG. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can find G on Twitter. She's right there at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Now, the possible motives and serious consequences of the recent terror attack and or hate crime at a gay nightclub in the U.S. city of Orlando, Florida, where American citizen of Afghan origin Omar Mateen killed 49 people and left dozens more wounded. For some insight into all of this, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with P.J. Crowley. He is a professor and distinguished fellow at George Washington University here in Washington. Also part of the conversation is James Carafano, vice president of the Heritage Foundation. Here's Carol now, who begins the conversation with a question for Carafano.
Another mass shooting, this one, though, in the middle of a contentious and polarizing presidential campaign. It seems to be a lone wolf, radicalized very possibly online, but it's also a hate crime. He attacked a gay nightclub. He himself may have had gay tendencies. It's hard to know. There's so many aspects to this. What's your takeaway from this terrible massacre?
Well, first, I do think we ought to make a distinction between something that's a mass shooting in which the shooter's motivation could be anything. Because in those scenarios, regardless of the cause of what they did, there was a whole sequence of public safety responses and countermeasures that you take regardless. And so that's a whole different conversation. As an incident of Islamist terrorism against the United States, the most remarkable thing about this terrorist attack is there's nothing remarkable about this terrorist attack. One of the things we do at Heritage is we have a timeline, a database of Islamist terror plots aimed at the United States since 9/11. By our count, this is number 86. Increasingly, in the last several years, this fits into a very clear pattern that we've seen. Out of the 22 last cases, almost all of them involved a U.S. citizen or U.S. person, somebody who's already here. This is a mode of attack of several that we've seen in the past. The biography of the person is not something that's unusual. What's interesting, though, is when you look at this group, other than the fact that, if you want to call it homegrown terrorism, it's very disparate. Different people, different targets, different weapons, different parts of the country. So in that respect, there is no clear pattern. But that, again, reflects, I think, what we've seen here is we don't have in the United States extensive extremist networks and groups for people to plug into. So what we're seeing is radicalization in small groups. I personally don't find the lone wolf distinction terribly helpful because almost nobody's a true lone wolf in the sense that they talk to no one, have contact with no one, give no indicators at all. For example, in this case, we know at least he had contact and discussions with his wife and maybe other people as well. But it's reflective of the nature of the Islamist terror threat that we see in the United States today.
PJ Crowley, your take.
I agree with everything that Jim just said. And I think it's important to recognize the evolution of the threat and the evolution of the conflict that we have been experiencing for the last 15 years. This is a very different war, you know, than the one that bin Laden started. And so you do have with the Islamic State a different phenomenon. Now, we don't know yet whether his declaration of allegiance to al-Baghdadi is something that came towards the end of a cycle of radicalization where he was intent on committing murder and then tried to put a religious veneer on it. That's entirely possible. But this is a very different kind of challenge for the United States than what we saw on 9/11. And the threat is evolving from plots that are developed from outside the country, and then you have a cell of people that penetrates the United States and then, you know, commits the kind of spectacular attack that we saw on 9/11. Now you do have individuals, do-it-yourself terrorism, radicalization in place, and we'll have to continue to try to understand that dynamic. We've been very successful in intercepting some of these plots. We've been very successful in intercepting people that have tried to go from the United States to join the caliphate in Syria. But again, I think this also reflects a maturing in terms of how the United States, the American people, you know, respond to this. We've had a number of plots that have been unsuccessful. We've had 3, 4, or 5, depending on how you count, in the last couple of years, you know, that have been successful, you know, the Boston Marathon bombing. But I think the American people are beginning to understand, as Jim said, because this is such a random, disparate threat, that we're just going to have to absorb these, learn from them, see what else we can do in terms of improving public safety. But this is a dimension of the struggle that we're going to be coping with for the indefinite future.
That is P.J. Crowley, a professor, distinguished fellow at George Washington University. He and James Carafano, vice president of the Heritage Foundation, speaking with Carol Castiel. She's host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look under the Programs tab for Encounter. Entrepreneurs from around the world attended a global summit in Silicon Valley. That's just outside the U.S. city of San Francisco, California. The meeting aimed at building connections among investors, educators, business representatives, and government officials. We get more now from VOA's Deborah Block.
The summit is tackling global challenges and deepening business ties around the world. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who spoke at the meeting, says creating economic opportunity and the potential for political stability go hand in hand.
The marketplace is moving faster. Ideas are moving faster. And we simply will not be able to keep up to solve the problems before us without the talent and contributions of this generation of entrepreneurs, of all of you.
Like entrepreneur Elsa Marie De Silva from India, who began Safe City, an online platform that collects crowdsourced data to help make cities safer by encouraging equal access to public spaces for everyone especially women.
And we've seen a lot of good work where police have changed their beat patrol timings or increased patrolling. Municipal authorities have fixed infrastructure like street lighting.
American Hobby Berry began a jewelry business in Africa called Fulaba, which helps provide jobs.
It's all handmade. All the materials are sourced from Guinea, West Africa. We work with local artisans there, and we're working on building a team.
A Malaysian startup called Hygie Energy helps to reduce the use of firewood and charcoal by converting agricultural waste into smokeless briquettes that produces cleaner energy. Jackie Yap started it.
I want to inspire more young people to actually explore into entrepreneurship at really young age and actually go for all the problems that you will be facing.
American entrepreneur Steve Case says entrepreneurship is especially difficult in countries without good infrastructure.
Some of the entrepreneurs from different parts of the world have some extra challenges, and we just need to be helpful where we can be helpful and helping them kind of take the next step.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
And I'm Steve Norman, also in Washington. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says images gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope a little over a month ago confirms the existence of a mysterious dark vortex in Neptune's atmosphere. While vortices on Neptune have been spotted several times in the past, dating back to 1989 when Voyager 2 flew past the planet, this recent Hubble observation marks the first time the phenomenon has been seen in the 21st century. The dark vortex, according to NASA, is actually a weather-related high-pressure system that travels through Neptune's atmosphere. Scientists say the size, shape, and stability of Neptune's dark vortices can vary, that they can wander throughout the atmosphere and travel at either slow to fast speeds. NASA says future observations and investigations could provide scientists with a better understanding of how the vortices are created, as well as what causes them to eventually disperse. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Singer-songwriter and actor Kris Kristofferson is celebrating his 80th birthday. Can you believe it? And while he and his family are dealing, also at the same time, with a recent health scare, my colleague Jim Stevenson caught up with Ray McDonald, host of the VOA Top 20 Countdown, for the latest on Kristofferson's health.
Why me, Lord? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the pleasures I've known?
This is an aging story with a twist, and it really caught my eye during a Rolling Stone profile of Kris Kristofferson, who is 80 years old.
Wow, already?
Yeah. Well, apparently he has been battling memory loss for several years, and doctors told him it was either due to Alzheimer's or possibly dementia, stemming from his younger years when he boxed, he played football, and also rugby. However, earlier this year, a doctor decided to test Kris Kristofferson for Lyme disease. Hmm. Now, the test came back positive. His wife, Lisa, thinks he might have picked it up from his time shooting the movie Disappearances when he was crawling around the forests of Vermont.
Lyme disease, of course, you know, it comes from those little ticks, spider-like things you can get out in the brush.
Lisa says Kris was taking all kinds of medications for conditions that he didn't suffer from. They all had side effects. After 3 weeks of treatment for Lyme disease, which generally involves a very strong antibiotic, doxycycline, Lisa says he's much better. He still has his bad days, but she says other times it's easy to think there's never been anything wrong with him. Fox News reports that only about 60% of Lyme disease cases show up when tested. So Lyme disease can be kind of a scary proposition, and it has all sorts of side effects. And you know, Jim, that for the longest time, doctors didn't even acknowledge its existence. Avril Lavigne is another high-profile celebrity who says she had a long battle with Lyme disease.
And it's good to see that he's back out there now.
Yeah. It's very encouraging that Kris Kristofferson seems to be on the way back from this. As I said, he's 80 years old, but he's still very much in the limelight. A box set of his first 11 albums is coming out on Friday, June 10th. He's been making albums since 1970. He also has a long list of movie and TV appearances. You might remember in 1976 he won a Golden Globe Award for co-starring with Barbara Streisand in A Star is Born. Chris is still active on camera. He's still touring, too. He once sang in the group The Highwaymen with Willie Nelson, and he and Willie have some concert appearances scheduled for the end of June, and they'll also show up at Willie's annual 4th of July picnic in Austin, Texas. So Kris Kristofferson, here's hoping that he has some more good years in front of him with his memory intact. Apparently, according to the profile in Rolling Stone, he's been very stoic about this whole thing. I mean, that's part of his nature. And as I say, it was one of the more interesting music stories that passed through my desk this week. And if you want to read the profile, you can. I put it on my Twitter feed, Ray on the Hits.
Excellent. Still going strong, as always, our Top 20 Countdown host, Ray McDonald. Ray, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
Are you a figment of my imagination? Or I one of yours? Want both now?
Yeah. He's a good one, isn't he? Still singing at 80 years old. I love it. I hope I can get anywhere near that. American pro basketball great Shaquille O'Neal has put on a basketball clinic that in Havana for local youngsters, becoming the latest emissary for the U.S. outreach to the people of Cuba. The 2016 Hall of Famer, a super four-time NBA champion, great guy. Recent months and years have seen a string of American sporting, diplomatic, and cultural missions to Cuba as Washington and Havana have been mending relations that were openly hostile for five decades, great deal of our lives. Huh? Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, about 60 million people around the world are internally displaced or living as refugees. Some left their homes to escape violence. Some fled famine, catastrophic flooding, or other natural disaster. It is the worst humanitarian crisis since the end of the Second World War, and half of the displaced are children under the age of 18. Crises that cause civilian populations to abandon their homes are doubly harmful to children because they disrupt some of the most protective and supportive environments in which children can live and learn. Add to this fact that too often, humanitarian response has not prioritized ensuring that displaced children can continue their formal education, and we may find that the future of an entire generation of children has been compromised. As crises have become longer, families are displaced for 20 years on average, children may spend their entire childhood exiled from their homes without education. A new generation grows up without the basic skills needed to contribute to their community and society, wrote U.S. Agency for International Development Director of Education Evelyn Rodriguez-Perez in a recent blog post. Today, around 75 million children between the ages of 3 and 18 in 35 countries are in urgent need of educational support. That is why the U.S. government is launching new initiatives to help youth in conflict areas continue their education. Today, the U.S. Department of State, in partnership with the leading virtual education provider, will begin a new initiative, Coursera for Refugees, to help refugees quickly build career skills and find employment through access to the 1,000-plus Coursera courses offered online. U.S. embassies and consulates will partner with local nonprofits to facilitate these courses in person. UNICEF launched the Education Cannot Wait Fund on May 23rd, which aims to help children continue their education in emergency situations. The goal is to build sustainable schools that will transition from crisis response to longer-term development of education systems. The fund hopes to elicit multi-year commitments from international donors, both public and private. There is an urgent need to ensure that kids who are forced into refuge are not denied an education. Education Cannot Wait has the potential to chart the path forward by developing the tools we need to deliver education, said U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Gail Smith. The United States has committed to an initial donation of $20 million for Education Cannot Wait. We urge all our friends and partners around the world to join us and invest in the future of those children who are in greatest need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's